KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Thousands of veterans across the country have been hurt by the extreme actions of Donald Trump, the Trump administration, Elon Musk, and MAGA.
Elon Musk's Doge says it's hard at work at the Pentagon and the VA, but it's unclear what that means.
Today is Thursday, March 6th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The Trump administration has been rapidly downsizing some parts of government.
That's not the case for parts of the Department of Homeland Security working on arrests and deportations of people without legal status.
I want to thank you. What a job they've all done. Everybody, Border Patrol, ICE.
And the sun is moving through space at 500,000 miles an hour.
Some stars in our galaxy were hurled through space even faster than that.
What can happen is one of the stars can get captured by the black hole. So it is basically ripped apart from its companion.
Plus, a look at Hulu's new series, Deli Boys.
That's ahead. First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. As Elon Musk and his Doge cost-cutting unit fire thousands of federal probationary employees and gut entire agencies, they're turning their attention to the Department of Education. NPR has obtained a draft of an executive order President Trump is expected to sign calling for the dismantling of the department. NPR's Corey Turner has more.
Hundreds of staff have been laid off or put on paid leave. The administration has also canceled hundreds of millions of dollars in education research grants. It's kind of ironic. This draft order complains that students have made little progress in reading or math over the years. And yet Trump's Department of Government Efficiency just cut programs focused specifically on improving reading and math instruction.
NPR's Corey Turner reporting. Lawmakers from both parties, along with Jewish civil rights groups, are criticizing the Trump administration for hiring a press aide at the Pentagon with a history of extreme comments. NPR's Tom Dreisbach has more.
Kingsley Wilson comes to the job of Deputy Pentagon Press Secretary with a history of controversial online posts. In one, Wilson said the United States is based on blood and soil. That slogan was popular in Nazi Germany and today among white nationalists. She also endorsed the extremist Great Replacement conspiracy theory, which falsely claims that elites are trying to replace white Americans with immigrants. And she appeared to support political violence, saying, quote, "There can be virtue in violence." The Anti-Defamation League, the American Jewish Committee, and the Jewish Council for Public Affairs criticized Wilson's comments, as did some Republicans and Democrats in Congress. The Department of Defense did not respond to NPR's request for comment. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
A federal judge today ruled the Trump administration has until Monday to pay nearly $2 billion that's owed to partners of the U.S. Agency for International Development and the State Department, reversing the administration's six-week funding freeze on all foreign assistance for work already done. Stocks tumbled today as investors reacted to President Trump's on-again, off-again tariff policies. And Pierre Scott Horsley reports.
Businesses don't like uncertainty, and there's been a lot of uncertainty in recent days. The week began with a free trade agreement in place between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, but President Trump tore that up and added 25% import taxes on most goods crossing the country's northern and southern borders. A day later, Trump carved out a temporary exception for North American automobiles, and now he's given a reprieve to most other imports, first from Mexico, then from Canada. Trump says all those breaks will expire in just another month. The ups and downs on policy have prompted similar ups and downs in the stock market, mostly down. The NASDAQ tumbled more than 2.5% and officially entered correction territory, 10% below its December peak. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. Elon Musk's SpaceX Starship failed on its eighth test mission today. The rocket started spinning out of control after engines went out and mission control lost contact with it. Debris from the Starship rained down over the Caribbean and caused flight delays in Florida for a time today. But the huge booster once again was successfully returned to the launch pad. That success aside, the failure of the rocket is a major setback for the Starlink program. Arts groups, including the National Queer Theater, are suing the National Endowment for the Arts over an executive order issued by President Trump requiring grant applicants to agree not to promote gender ideology in their work. NPR's Chloe Veltman has more.
The American Civil Liberties Union filed the suit on behalf of four arts groups with the U.S. District Court for the District of Rhode Island. The suit seeks to dial back an executive order that forces grant applicants to certify that they will not use federal funds to, quote, promote gender ideology. Vera Edelman is the ACLU's lead counsel on the case.
This new prohibition forcing artists to be a mouthpiece for government views runs directly counter to the point of the NEA and to the point of art in general, which is to explore ideas, explore the diversity of human experience.
The NEA did not respond to a request for comment. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Wall Street sharply lower by the closing bell. The Dow down 427 points. That's down nearly 1%. NASDAQ down nearly 2.5%. That's a loss of 483 points. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital markets solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. The entity known as DOGE, led by billionaire Elon Musk, is touting its cost-cutting measures across the federal workforce. But as NPR and others have documented, the Department of Government Efficiency's math does not always add up. Now, DOGE says it's busy at work at both the Pentagon and the Department of Veterans Affairs. At this point, it's not entirely clear what that means. So for more, we begin with NPR's Pentagon correspondent, Tom Bowman. Hey there.
Hey, Juana.
Tom, tell us what you're hearing from the Pentagon.
Well, the Pentagon put out a memo on Monday saying the firings would start that day. They are looking to cut tens of thousands of probationary employees and using that money to pay for priorities such as more drone ships and submarines. But Juana, we're not getting a lot of detail from the Pentagon about where those cuts will come from. I'm getting calls from contacts in the Army, Air Force, and Defense Health Agency about job cuts that have already taken place. One Air Force officer told his subordinates, get this, he's learning more from Facebook than his own command.
Huh.
Officials say cuts will start with so-called low performers and also those jobs, the Pentagon says, that are, quote, not in the public interest. An Army veteran who worked at the Defense Health Agency said she got cut with a notice saying she was a low performer. But get this, 6 months ago, she got a stellar performance review she shared with me. It says she exceeded all objectives and her work was truly transformative. I spoke with a Capitol Hill aide who said they're trying to get details about how decisions are made in the scope of these firings.
This sounds pretty confusing, I got to say. Is that how people inside the Defense Department tell you they're feeling too?
Oh, it's very confusing. I'm getting calls from some contacts inside the government and as well as neighbors asking me what I've heard. Some information is being put out on social media accounts run by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and other officials. But again, no great detail, just kind of this broad brush with terms like, quote, streamline operations, prioritize critical missions. And this vagueness, confusion, and there's also a lack of coordination. It's all having an impact on operations. I was talking with a retired officer in Europe who works for the Pentagon on training missions with other countries. They have two budget analysts who left, and they can't replace them because there's also a civilian hiring freeze.
Thank you so much, Tom. At this point, I want to bring in NPR's Quill Lawrence for more on the confusion these moves are creating. And Quill, you cover Veterans Affairs, and I know that you reported this week that the Office of Personnel Management has frozen the VA out of its own hiring software.
Yeah, it's a program called USA Staffing, and OPM is sort of runs HR for many federal agencies. We heard from VAs and sources in at least seven states that VA couldn't send out hire letters because they were frozen out of their own HR software. That's for medical staff like doctors and nurses who are supposed to be exempt from the hiring freeze. And VA says it's coming up with a workaround, but it seems like two parts of the government pitted against each other, where DOGE and OPM are making these firings, and the VA is scrambling to undo or work around what they do. Twice, for example, now they fired staff from VA suicide crisis hotline who are not exempt from the hiring freeze, but then VA scrambled to rehire them because they are mission critical. It's a suicide hotline. They announced a sudden cut of 875 contracts. That was over a week ago, and then they pulled that back, and now they're floating a different list of contracts that are being cut. And staff I'm talking with say that this is not inspiring confidence for these crucial hires they need. Doctors and nurses are in demand, and they're worried people will think twice about picking a job at VA.
You also reported this week on an internal VA memo that they plan to downsize and lay off, I think it was something like 70 to 80,000 staff. I mean, here's my question. Can they do that without affecting veterans' care or benefits?
VA Secretary Doug Collins says that they can. He says they're going to carefully figure out how to get back to 2019 staff levels without affecting health care or benefits decisions. Collins says in the past, the VA just kept on adding staff and funds, and his approach is to stress more about efficiency. And the VA, it's huge, but you know, it takes care of about 9 million veterans, and their mission is that they have to be wherever the vets are. If they're here in New York City or they're in Nome, Alaska, they have to go to them. And I mean, VA staff did grow about 80,000 since 2019, and that's mostly because they were added to deal with something called the PACT Act. So Congress passed the PACT Act to expand VA care and include veterans who got exposed to burn pits in Iraq or Agent Orange in Vietnam, radiation. And they brought millions of vets into VA care, and VA went on a hiring spree to take care of them. It's not going to be easy to cut them, especially at this pace.
Right.
And veterans say, you know, they already paid for this care by sucking dust, toxic dust in Iraq or Agent Orange in Vietnam.
That's NPR's Quil Lawrence and Tom Bowman. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
The Trump administration's been busy shrinking some arms of government. One exception is the Department of Homeland Security. They're trying to grow the number of federal employees working on arrests and deportations of people without legal status. NPR immigration policy reporter Ximena Bustillo is covering this. Hi there.
Hey.
What other federal employees are being pulled in to work on immigration right now?
It really ranges. Most are already in some type of federal law enforcement division of their own agency. Thinking about groups like the Federal Bureau of Investigations or the Internal Revenue Service's Criminal Investigations Unit. DHS also boasted that it got 600 State Department officials to conduct arrests, and they are using the Drug Enforcement Administration. They're also relying on the Federal Bureau of Prisons to increase detention capacity. All of this is done specifically to bolster the Immigration and Customs Enforcement branch of DHS, commonly known as ICE.
In previous administrations, we've seen federal employees pulled into other agencies to help them. Is there something different about what the Trump administration is doing now?
Right. There seems to be an expansion of the duties that federal employees might be tasked with. For example, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem asked for qualified IRS enforcement personnel to assist ICE. She outlined a series of needs that ranged from assisting with investigations all the way to physically deporting people who lack legal status. I spoke with Sarah Saldana. She was the ICE director under former President Barack Obama. She said that it isn't unusual for agencies to assist each other with investigations, particularly when it comes to investigating crimes like unlawful employment, human or drug trafficking, or fraud. But she's concerned about going beyond that.
A Homeland Security investigative agent might need very much to collect evidence relating to illegal activities that this person may have participated in. But two different directions, two different roads, two different missions. It does not make sense to me on the removal side.
The exception here is the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and this was a practice brought back from the first Trump administration. ICE has long struggled with capacity to house those arrested.
Are you also seeing people within the Department of Homeland Security get reassigned to work on immigration?
Yes. So the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services employees received an email obtained by my colleague, investigative reporter Kiara Eisner. These are employees that help process citizenship and application benefits. The email said that employees' names had been put forward to provide staffing support for ICE in the future. This email was sent to at least employees investigating immigration-related fraud.
How are agency leaders and employees responding to this effort to expand ICE's forces?
We don't really know how everyone feels about it yet. A former official who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss private conversations told me that with these task forces, some officers see the added support as useful, but there can also be concerns in delegating ICE tasks and the mission to other types of law enforcement groups. But we do know that a group of Democratic senators sent a letter to Attorney General Pam Bondi that said that they were worried that the Bureau of Prison Facilities might not be able to handle requests from ICE to detain immigrants. A BOP employee added in a letter that they, quote, did not sign up for this and have not been trained for it.
That is NPR's Ximena Bustillo. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our closest star, the sun, is moving through space going about 500,000 miles per hour. Now, that may seem fast, but some stars in our galaxy go way faster than that. And as NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, it turns out that some of these speedy stars were hurled through space by a massive black hole that's been hiding nearby.
Hypervelocity stars go at ridiculous speeds, like several million miles per hour. They go so fast they have achieved escape velocity. They are saying goodbye to the Milky Way, unlike our slowpoke sun, which orbits our galaxy's center.
These stars are moving too fast to sustain such an orbit. They're just on their way out. They're never going to come back again.
Jesse Hahn is an astronomer with the Harvard and Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. He says hypervelocity stars start out as normal stars that are part of a binary system. That's two stars orbiting each other. But if this happy pair ventures too close to a powerful black hole,
what can happen is one of the stars can get captured by the black hole. So it is basically ripped apart from its companion.
And the surviving companion star goes flying off. Hahn and some colleagues recently used a space telescope called Gaia to study 21 hypervelocity stars. They traced the stars' paths backwards.
Sort of common wisdom was they should all come from our galactic center, where we know with certainty that there is a supermassive black hole.
And about half of them did. But it turns out the rest came from our closest neighboring galaxy, the Large Magellanic Cloud. Hahn says this means that galaxy must contain a monster black hole that's about 600,000 times the mass of our sun. And now that researchers know that,
the search is on and we're using all the telescopes we can to look for it.
This would be the closest giant black hole outside of our galaxy. A cosmic beast that's been lurking unseen right next door. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from ECMC Foundation at ECMCFoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. It's time for our Science News Roundup from Shortwave, NPR's science podcast. I'm joined by two of the show's reporters, Emily Kwong and Rachel Carlson. Good to have you both back here.
Hey, Ari.
Hey, Ari. Good to be with you.
As usual, you've brought us three science stories that caught your attention this week. What are they?
A new flower species called the woolly devil.
How to drink lemonade in virtual reality.
And how early humans may have made tools from bones 1.5 million years ago.
These sound delightful. Can we start with early humans making tools out of bones? Rachel, tell us about it.
Let's do it. So archaeologists know early humans used stone to make tools. That usually meant knocking rocks against one another to get like sharp flakes for cutting animal carcasses or plants. And the Acheulean period, about 1.5 million years ago, way before Homo sapiens showed up, was known for stone hand axes. They're sort of oval or teardrop-shaped rocks with sharp points.
But a new study out this week in Nature suggests early humans in Eastern Africa were also using bone to make tools like this, too. Ignacio de la Torre is a study author and archaeologist. He works at the Spanish National Research Council, and he says this dates the production of bone tools 1 million years earlier than scientists thought.
Wow, so there might be a bone age in addition to a stone age.
Correct.
Huh? Wow. So do the tools actually teach us anything about how smart these ancient human ancestors were or how they lived?
Well, Tom Plummer is a paleoanthropologist at Queens College in New York and wasn't involved in this research, but he says the paper suggests early humans were using mental imaging to make these tools, which means like maybe they had an image in their heads of something and then used their hands to replicate that image.
They're just like us, just puzzling along.
Just more hair.
Yeah, that's right. Ignacio thinks that this shows advancements in cognition, since early humans took what they knew about stone tools and how those were shaped, and then just applied it to new materials like elephant and hippopotamus bones.
Now we have a human species here that is able to create an innovation by applying a knowledge they know they have for the working of stone. They're applying this to a new raw material.
But Ignacio also noted the paper opens even more questions than it solves. So he wants to know, could they find even older bones? And why was there a million-year gap between these and the previously found bone tools? So there's still a lot of questions about some of our early ancestors.
Intriguing. Well, let's shift from our ancient past to our science fiction present. Tell me about drinking lemonade in virtual reality. What does that mean?
Okay, so are you familiar with VR?
Of course.
Have you played it?
No.
Oh, well, you should, because it's this super immersive gaming experience. You strap on a pair of goggles and you can see or hear another world. But Ari, imagine you could also taste another world.
Calorie-free, I would imagine.
Yes, yes. What if in virtual reality you could taste lemonade served by someone in a kitchen on the other side of the country?
Not just a simulation of lemonade, but actually how sweet or sour they made it specifically?
Yes, yes. Not the lemonade, but a simulation that matched their recipe. Researchers have been trying to do this in all kinds of ways, and Jinghua Li is one of them. She's a professor of materials science and engineering at The Ohio State University. Her team invented this device called E-Taste and described it in the journal Science Advances.
How does E-Taste work?
So there's two parts. There's a small sensor patch that researchers dipped into store-bought lemonade, and that patch is attuned to recognize molecules like glucose and glutamate, chemicals that represent the five basic tastes of sweet, sour, salty, bitter, umami. Data from lemonade in California was sent hundreds of miles away to Jinghua's lab in Ohio.
And then in a matter of seconds, the data was wirelessly passed to this tiny device filled with edible chemicals, which then combined into a synthetic replica of the lemonade. And that cocktail of flavors was pumped across a volunteer's tongue. And voila, someone in Ohio is tasting a glass of lemonade in California. Here's Jinghua.
The long-term goal here is for us to establish like the new way for people to interact with each other.
I'm going to maintain that I would still be able to tell the difference between the chemical simulation of lemonade and actual lemon juice and sugar, but can e-taste recreate more complicated flavors like, I don't know, beef bourguignon or something?
So not really, unfortunately not, because, and Jinghua is the first person to admit this, taste is not the same thing as flavor. Mm. You know this, you cook. Right. Nimesha Ranasinghe at the University of Maine reminded me that a lot of flavor is actually aroma.
Food smells.
Yeah, and then you also got food's temperature and texture.
And even the background noise and ambient lighting and our memories and experiences, there are so many other factors affecting our flavors.
But Nimesha finds e-taste super interesting and is really curious about scalability. Will we see VR dining one day? Could there be medical applications? Maybe a version of e-taste could help doctors diagnose the loss of taste from long COVID or traumatic brain injury.
Wow. Okay, for our third and final story, Rachel, will you tell us about the woolly devil, which is neither made of wool nor a devil?
No, yeah. The woolly devil is a new flower to science found recently in the desert landscape of Big Bend National Park in Texas. It's called the woolly devil because it's covered in this whitish fuzzy fur with a hint of yellow in the middle. Some are no bigger than half an inch in size, and these little plants were camouflaged in the rocks, which probably explains why they haven't been documented before.
Who discovered these little flowers?
Okay, so it was park volunteer Deb Manley and employee Kathy Hoyt were on a hike in the backcountry, and they spotted this star-shaped flower. They took a picture and uploaded it to iNaturalist, that's the online network for identifying plants and animals. And Isaac Lichter Mark, an evolutionary biologist, figured out that the flower didn't match any of the other images on iNaturalist. He told our colleague James Dubek about this.
They took pictures and then that kind of caused an uproar. They caused an email chain of different botanists emailing each other. And so, yeah, we called ourselves Team Woolly.
Okay, what did Team Woolly determine about this new flower?
Well, they thought it was a sunflower, and Ari, I want you to picture a sunflower in your mind's eye. Mm-hmm. It looks a single flower to most of us, but it's actually a flower head made up of lots of tiny flowers, and then it all comes together to look like one big flower.
Huh.
This new plant had the same feature, so it was giving sunflower in its own woolly way. And after looking at the DNA and its physical features in a scanning electron microscope, researchers were surprised to find that the woolly devil was not only a new species, but it was one rank higher than that. It represents a whole new genus within the larger family that contains sunflowers.
This is major. Team Woolly must be thrilled.
Yes.
They are. But Ari, these flowers have only been found in a few places in Big Bend, which has had a drought in recent years. So the researchers say even though sunflowers are known to be resilient in lots of different kinds of climates, mm-hmm. this new genus of plant could have a rough road ahead.
Why you gotta end on a bummer?
I know, I'm sorry.
Rachel Carlson.
Drink some lemonade.
Okay. Rachel Carlson and Emily Kwong from NPR Science Podcast Shortwave, which you can follow for new discoveries, everyday mysteries, and the science behind the headlines. Thank you both.
Thank you,
Ari. Thanks, Ari.
This is NPR News.
Queen of the Ring is a new biopic about Mildred Burke, one of the first ever professional female wrestlers. Burke wrestled over 200 men in her career, was a three-time world champion, and a single mom.
Mildred Burke was a dreamer, a trailblazer, who defied the era that she was in.
Her journey to the ring on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Sesame Workshop, the parent company of the iconic children's series, is downsizing.
The linear cable networks, which dominated the field, like Nickelodeon, Disney, have really had a massive drop-off.
What does that mean for your family after news?
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The White House says it has brought down migrant encounters at the U.S.-Mexico border to a historic low. As NPR's Jasmine Garis reports, the numbers come as President Trump promises to continue an unprecedented campaign of mass deportations.
Customs and Border Protection has not yet released its official numbers for the month of February, but President Donald Trump says that it's a historic low. 8,326 apprehensions by Border Patrol agents on the southern border. For comparison, back in 2023, the U.S.-Mexico border saw a record high number of border apprehensions, nearly 250,000. However, migrant encounters began decreasing mid-last year, going down to about 96,000 by December 2024. In a statement, the Trump administration said, quote, illegal border crossers have given up and are returning to their own countries. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
A former Olympic snowboarder for Canada has been added to the FBI's list of 10 most wanted fugitives. Authorities say he's wanted for allegedly leading a violent drug trafficking organization. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
Ryan Wedding represented Canada at the 2002 Winter Olympics. He was indicted last year in the United States on federal charges, including conspiracy to export cocaine and murder. Court papers say the drug trafficking network allegedly run by Wedding has shipped massive amounts of cocaine to the U.S. and Canada and has orchestrated multiple murders to further its drug business. The FBI says Wedding is believed to reside in Mexico, but that he could be in the U.S., Canada, or Central America. The State Department, meanwhile, is offering a $10 million reward for information leading to Wedding's arrest. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
And you're listening to NPR. In central Ukraine, at least four people were killed today and dozens more injured by a Russian ballistic missile attack. NPR's Polina Litvinova reports from Kyiv that Russian forces were targeting a hotel.
Rescue workers cleared rubble the whole night after a Russian missile struck a hotel in the Ukrainian city Kryvyi Rih. The Russian military has frequently targeted Kryvyi Rih since the Kremlin's full-scale war against Ukraine started in 2022. The city's governor says in addition to the hotel, 14 apartment buildings, a post office and 12 shops were damaged. Zelensky wrote on social media that Ukrainian, American and British volunteers from a humanitarian organization had checked into the hotel before the attack. There were no casualties among them. He also stated, quote, there can be no pause in the pressure on Russia to stop this war and terror against life. Polina Litvinova, NPR News, Kyiv.
Lawmakers in Utah have passed the first state legislation that requires app stores like Apple and Google to verify users' ages, as well as getting parental consent for minors to download apps to their devices. Similar bills have been proposed in at least a dozen other states over concerns about children's digital safety. That legislation passed in Utah, now headed to the governor's desk for his signature. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from your part-time controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Vice President J.D. Vance traveled to the southern U.S. border yesterday, underscoring President Trump's work to crack down on illegal immigration. It's the kind of trip a vice president typically makes after a State of the Union kind of address, and it did not make a lot of headlines, unlike some of Vance's other recent moves. NPR's Franco Ordonez has more on Vance's unusual role as White House provocateur.
When Donald Trump took the stage at his victory party on election night, he acknowledged some early criticism about picking Vance as his running mate.
I took a little heat at the beginning.
Vance had a rough start on the campaign trail as past comments about, quote, childless cat ladies and other culture war issues came to light. But Trump said he liked Vance's style.
And he is a feisty guy, isn't he?
Vance took Trump's case to cable news, trolled critics over social media, and attacked Harris and Biden relentlessly.
He's still like the only guy I've ever seen. He really looks forward to it, and then he just goes and absolutely obliterates them.
Vance doubled down once Trump took office, especially on foreign policy.
In Britain and across Europe, free speech, I fear, is in retreat.
At the Munich Security Conference in February, U.S. leaders usually pay tribute to allies, but not Vance. He scolded European leaders.
The threat that I worry the most about vis-a-vis Europe is not Russia, it's not China, it's not any other external actor. And what I worry about is the threat from within.
It turns out this isn't the first time a vice president has played the role of attack dog in an administration.
It would often be designed to allow the president to stay above the fray.
Joel Goldstein is a vice presidential scholar at St. Louis University. He says Richard Nixon did this too when he was vice president, so that Dwight Eisenhower could act more presidential. And then Spiro Agnew later did it for Nixon. But this time, there's something different.
In this case, that's not what's going on, because Vance isn't playing a role which is designed to allow President Trump to refrain from that sort of rhetoric. Vance is really reinforcing and doubling down on the sort of rhetoric that President Trump uses and models.
In an administration where everyone is on the offensive, it makes it hard for allies, says Corey Shockey, who worked in the George W. Bush White House.
The problem with that is that there is nobody playing the good cop in the Trump administration. There's nobody friends and allies feel like they can talk to get a fair hearing.
And it's different from Trump's first term, says Shockey, now at the American Enterprise Institute. She says former Vice President Mike Pence always backed Trump's policies, but Pence made the case for those policies in friendlier ways.
Whereas Vice President Vance makes arguments that are less reasonable and more antagonistic than those the president makes.
Aides to Vance and Trump say they have a unified strategy. Stephen Chung, the White House communications director, said Vance and Trump are in lockstep, working together on these issues. He says critics are, quote, simply uneducated to this powerful form of leadership and governance.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to have President Zelensky of Ukraine.
Trump showed he had his vice president's back last week. With cameras rolling, Vance accused Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky of disrespecting the president in the Oval Office.
Have you said thank you once this entire meeting? No, in this entire meeting, have you said thank you? You went to Pennsylvania and campaigned for the opposition in October. Offer some words of appreciation for the United States of America and the president who's trying to save your country.
Please, you think that if you will speak very loudly about the war, you
He's
can
He's not speaking loudly. He's not speaking loudly. Your country is in big trouble.
Can I
Wait a minute. No, no.
Can
You've
I
done
answer?
A lot of talking. Your country is in big trouble. I
know. In recent times, vice presidents have tended to be seen but not heard in these Oval Office events. But Vance is showing he doesn't plan to stick to that tradition. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, The White House.
Sesame Workshop, the parent company of Sesame Street, announced yesterday that it is significantly downsizing. The move comes just 2 months after Max said it would discontinue streaming this children's program after 2025. What led to this decision, and what could the potential impact be on employees and viewers? NPR's Elizabeth Blair is here in the studio with more. Hi there.
Hi.
So, Elizabeth, what can you tell us about these layoffs?
The layoffs started yesterday. Sesame Workshop said it needed to reduce the size of the organization because of the changing media and funding landscape, and to ensure that it could fulfill its mission for years to come. I interviewed Phoebe Gilpin, who one of the employees who was laid off. She said that Sesame Workshop CEO Sherry Weston told staff that 20% of the workforce would be affected. Sesame Workshop would not confirm that number. As of 2022, the company had about 850 employees, so 20% is about 170 people. But again, we don't know for sure if that's the number.
Okay, but what do we know about who's being laid off? Are we talking puppeteers or like Big Bird?
No, not Big Bird, not Elmo, not Cookie Monster. Sesame Workshop says no puppeteers were laid off, but content creators and administrative staff are among those affected. Sesame Workshop is a nonprofit, so its mission is to help educate kids. So in addition to puppeteers and writers and celebrity guests, you have child development experts and people who work with schools, and Phoebe Gilpin was one of those.
We're struggling to imagine how people that are remaining are going to be able to fulfill on this mission, to have the impact in the world that we want to have every single day.
Now, Elizabeth, you wrote about this yesterday, and you noted that Sesame Workshop is facing this very difficult media landscape, which is what the company said led to these layoffs. Any more specifics about what they meant?
Right. I mean, every media company is facing this changing media landscape. I mean, people might remember that back in 2015, Sesame Street signed a deal with what was then HBO and now is Max. And that gave the show an infusion of cash that allowed them to produce more new episodes every season. But last December, Max announced it would not renew its contract with the show. The economics of the media business are not pretty right now. I talked to media consultant Gary Nell. He's a former CEO and president of Sesame Workshop and of NPR.
The traditional kids media business has been massively disrupted. So the linear cable networks, which dominated the field, like Nickelodeon, Disney, Cartoon Network, and to some extent PBS Kids, have really had a massive drop off in viewership and have been pretty much replaced by YouTube, who now is by far the largest distributor of kids content. Kids are going for short form video content like everyone else.
And Elizabeth, I have to ask you, in service of all of the families, all of the parents and the kids who love Sesame Street, does any of this mean that Sesame Street is going to be affected immediately?
No, fear not.
Thank you.
New episodes will continue on Max through September. Reruns of Sesame Street will continue on PBS. And Sesame Workshop says production of season 56 will begin next month. But Sesame Workshop has not yet announced a new distributor.
That is NPR correspondent Elizabeth Blair. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Juana.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Texas Democrat Al Green has become the 28th lawmaker ever to be censured by the House. This comes after Green stood up in protest during President Trump's address to Congress this week. 10 Democrats voted with Republicans to rebuke their colleague, a sign of a party still struggling to find a unified strategy to oppose President Trump. Joining us to talk through this is NPR congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunt. Hi there.
Hi, Ari.
Take us back to that outburst on Tuesday night. How did it go down?
Yeah, not that long into President Trump's speech, Congressman Green stood up, started shouting at the president that he doesn't have a mandate. House Speaker Mike Johnson warned Green that he could be removed if he didn't stop interrupting, but Green kept at it.
Take your seat, sir. Take your seat. Find it
that members continue to engage in willful and concerted disruption of proper decorum, the chair now directs the sergeant at arms to restore order. Remove this gentleman from the chamber.
So certainly a rare and very dramatic scene there. And Republicans quickly mobilized and readied a censure resolution against Green the very next day.
What does that do? What power does a censure hold?
Well, a censure resolution is essentially a formal rebuke for violating the chamber's code of conduct. It doesn't hold much power beyond that public admonishment. Historically, they're pretty rare, but there has been an uptick in recent years. Green is actually the fifth member of Congress to be censured since 2021.
In the past, we've seen members of Congress heckle and interrupt a presidential speech. How much of a bigger deal is it for a member of Congress to be removed?
I mean, it's a much bigger deal. But, you know, to your point, that is pretty much what Democrats were arguing last night when there was debate on this resolution on the House floor. Massachusetts Democrat Jim McGovern kept pointing out times when Republican members interrupted former President Joe Biden during his State of the Union addresses.
I appreciate your selective outrage. But you'd have more credibility had you expressed outrage when your colleagues were heckling Joe Biden.
Republicans like California's Doug LaMalfa say they've been disappointed at outbursts from their side of the aisle as well over the years, but that decorum matters.
But you don't act that way. You don't completely disrupt the operations of this chamber for your own theater. And that's what I'm afraid it was.
What did Congressman Green have to say?
Well, he said that it wasn't an emotional outburst. It was something that he did very intentionally. He felt he was speaking up for his constituents, and he basically said, no regrets.
The officers who escorted me out, they were kind to me. I don't blame the speaker for anything. Friends, I would do it again.
And Barbara, how do you interpret the fact that 10 of Green's fellow Democrats joined in the vote to censure him?
I think this is just the latest example of Democrats sort of grappling internally with having a unified strategy in how to push back against the president. Democratic Party leaders had asked their members before Trump's address to maintain a dignified, somber presence in the chamber during Trump's speech. And while Green is the standout example of not doing that, there were many other Democrats who booed the president. Some left mid-speech wearing T-shirts that said resist. So it just highlights for me this divide of how Democrats are figuring out being the opposition party. Clearly, some members think that bold moves that get a lot of attention is the right approach. Others, including some of these Democrats who voted to censure Green, say that that just detracts from keeping the focus on what the Republican Party is doing and how people are affected by those policies.
That's NPR congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunt. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The actor Poorna Jagannathan has played roles that subvert some of the most tired South Asian stereotypes we usually see on screen. Like the mom she portrayed in the comedy TV series Never Have I Ever.
Even though I won't let you date, I do care if you're heartbroken.
Yeah, it's about a boy. And I really, really liked him.
Come here.
She's also played the South Asian doctor, but one with a side hustle, doing favors for shady characters played by Brad Pitt and George Clooney in the movie Wolfs.
Do you know what he took?
Not sure.
Well, it must have been some bad combination or something extremely pure.
And now, in the new Hulu series Deli Boys by creator Abdullah Saeed, Jagannathan's latest role may be her most trope-bending yet. The show centers on two spoiled Pakistani-American brothers who've inherited an empire of convenience stores, only to discover that the business their dad left behind is actually a front for a drug-dealing ring. Jagannathan plays a crime boss named Lucky, a maternal figure with a murderous streak.
Oh, I know what you're thinking. Oh, has Lucky Auntie gone crazy? I just didn't expect both of you to show up here. Come on. But I guess this is the kismet Allah chose for us. Go eat. Very nice. Good boy.
When I spoke with her this week, I asked her what drew her to this role of half Pakistani auntie, half gangster.
I have a teenage son. Do you have kids, Elsa?
I don't have kids, but I can imagine what it might be like to have a teenage son and wanting to be a gangster as the mom.
You have to be a gangster. You have to out-gangster them, actually. Yeah. That's your only job. I'm only partly kidding, by the way.
Have to be maternal, but you also have to be a little bit brutal at times. What are you getting at?
Yes, yeah? Bit of a spy, you know, so many combinations. When I read the script, it's based on opposites, right? The two brothers are, well, they're just opposite to each other. Yeah. And Lucky's, how she expresses, be it love or anger, are opposites. So she's super maternal and, you know, just super sweet. Uh-huh. And then, you know, when she's angry, when she takes care of business, she'll just put a bullet through someone's head the next second.
I mean, also, you're in your 50s now.
Yes.
You've had many, many years of acting experience. What is it like to graduate in your 50s to playing a gangster? Like, what feels so right about that at this stage in your career to play a criminal?
I've been getting a lot of power roles for the last maybe decade, and I've always hated them, like just hated them.
What do you see as a power role?
You know, the woman like saying, no, this thing is not right. What are you doing? Or firing someone, or just in control of a room, the boss. Like, I had to put Mark Wahlberg in his place. It was all really hard. Like, it was hard. The second I turned 50, it just came so easily.
Oh, I love that.
Like, now when I enter any room, when I go through and move through the world, it's a feeling of being rightfully there, and that's fine.
What I also love about the show, beyond your character, is this show, it seems intent on breaking down cliches about South Asian immigrants, about the model minority myth.
Like, right.
I love how the whole front for this crime family is a convenience store.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, South Asians owning convenience stores in the U.S. is kind of a stereotype, right? And I love how that stereotype is the whole cover for criminal activity in the show. Like, it subverts the model minority myth.
Totally. And it's like, you know, America grew up on a diet of an Indian character owning a convenience store, which is Apu in The Simpsons.
Yeah.
But that character, wasn't written by us or for us.
Or performed. I mean,
exactly.
It was performed by a white person.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And so that was, you know, we never stopped to get Apu's real story. We never went beyond the stereotype. And so with Deli Boys, we're really seeing a move from Apu, who used to be the punchline, to Deli Boys, which is the plot line.
Yeah.
So it really takes that old trope and very much subverts it.
Like, you think this is what we are? All right, go ahead and think that. We're going to do other stuff in the background.
It's a
underground.
Front. Yeah. A true front. Yeah. Yeah. But I also say, like, you know, South Asians have been always portrayed as the cab driver and the deli and, you know, terrorists.
Totally.
And the Deli Boys now gives people the opportunity to portray us as drug dealers as well. Yes, thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Yay. Thank you.
Well, I mean, that's another thing. The show, it is so funny. Yes, it has cultural references, but the show didn't necessarily have to be about a Pakistani family.
That's right.
Like, Pakistani identity isn't the central driver of the plot.
Yes, and although it's a very strong undercurrent, the way we eat, the way we pray, where we pray, how we feed each other, what we're doing, you know, all that is very South Asian Pakistani, yeah. The way we speak, like when we're really angry, we'll curse in Urdu. But yeah, so the undercurrent is definitely us, but specific, but the themes are just ridiculously universal.
Exactly.
And the laughter is universal.
Exactly. I also adored how the woman is the one with the clarity and decisiveness and, frankly, the balls to be the leader here. Like, pretty much every single man on the show is
incompetent.
Hapless.
Yes. Just incompetent.
Not you. How good did that feel?
I mean, I think the Lucky is very much Lucky is based on Abdullah's mom, Seema, who is a single mom, raised, you know, two boys, and she's an incredible woman. But Lucky is also based on our showrunner Michelle, our producer Jenny Connor, who are all in the writers' room. Like, they are all Lucky aunties through and through. And, you know, they've been in rooms where they've always been underestimated. They've always had to take, you know, be in charge. They've always had to clean up men's messes. Like, that's who they are. And so, therefore, that is very much the essence of Lucky. She's a cleanup man.
Well, all right. Now that Deli Boys is out there, like, where do you go next after Gangster Auntie? Like, what's the next barrier-breaking role for you if you could dream one up?
Oh, I think I might be in my gangster phase for a long time. I can't envision getting out of it, actually. It just feels so right for this time of my life. Come on,
you make
Green.
The 50 sound amazing. If I could be in a gangster phase in a couple years, I'd be set.
Yes,
I'd be thrilled.
The thing that it's so hard to explain is that it just comes to you. You don't go to it anymore. Like, my favorite, the word I used to be so afraid of is saying no, and it is my favorite word now.
Isn't it a beautiful word?
Yeah.
I cannot wait for my gangster era. Porna Jagannathan stars in the new Hulu show, Deli Boys. Thank you for this conversation. This was so much fun, Porna.
I am so, so grateful to be on here with you, Elsa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at zquil.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to power.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some, until I first met you I was lonesome. And when you came inside, dear, my heart grew light, and this old world seemed new to me. You're really swell, I have to admit you deserve expressions that really fit you. And so I've racked my brain hoping to explain all the things that you do to me. By mere bits to shame, please let me explain.